As Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip enters its 164th day, Doctors Without Borders says the situation in the territory is catastrophic and words cannot describe it. There are reports of dozens of casualties as Israeli forces launch another attack in Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital, where thousands of displaced Palestinians have taken shelter. And rising tensions on the Korean Peninsula, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea launches multiple ballistic missiles as the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, visits neighboring South Korea for talks. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Gaza Strip is enduring relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling as more Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh attacks. The regime has targeted several areas near the southern city of Khan Yunis. They include Hamad Town, where five dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble. Israeli warplanes also struck some neighborhoods in Gaza City and its vicinity. The regime shelled east of the Beraish refugee camp and targeted homes in the Nuseirat camp in central Gaza as well. That led to the killing of several Palestinians. Israel unleashed its war in Gaza in early October. Over 31,600 Palestinians have been killed so far. The war rages on, while Gazans are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid severe food shortages. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says people in the coastal sliver are on the brink of famine. Doctors Without Borders also say that the current situation in Gaza is catastrophic and indescribable. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israel has launched a fresh operation against Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, which is sheltering tens of thousands of Palestinians displaced by the regime's onslaught. Witnesses in Gaza City say tanks surrounded the hospital site and nearby areas have been bombed. Gaza's health ministry says it has received information that shows there are dozens of casualties. It has said the Israeli attack set off a fierce fire in one of the buildings, the compound. Hamas resistance movement has called the storming of Al-Shifa Hospital a war crime. The Israeli military has carried out multiple operations in and around medical facilities across the Gaza Strip since the start of its genocide on October 7. According to the UN, 155 health facilities in the Gaza Strip have been damaged since then. Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and activist joining us from Belfast. We also have Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us from Sydney. Welcome to you both. Fra Hughes, I'll start with you. When it comes to the Israeli aggression, in particular when it comes to the hospitals, there hasn't been really a solid piece of news that came out showing that Israeli objective was met, whatever that was, which at the forefront is trying to extinguish the Hamas fighters in one form or another. Why is it that they're continuing with their targeting of the hospitals, do you think?
I think it's a further attack on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza itself. I think the president of Brazil, Luiz da Silva, probably encapsulated this best when I'm paraphrasing him, when he said basically it's an asymmetrical war. What we have is a well-trained, well-armed, well-equipped army fighting civilians. So that, to me, is the best description of what's happening in Gaza. We saw previous attacks, I believe, on the Al-Shifa Hospital. Is that the hospital where they said there were tunnels underneath and that they were trying to release captives? It appears that there is no lie too big and there is no atrocity too small that the Israeli offensive forces are not prepared to carry out on the people of Gaza. So when you couple the attacks on the hospitals, if you remember the six young innocent babies who were left to die in their incubators when another hospital, people were forced to evacuate the sick, the wounded, and even the people undergoing intensive care treatment. We're just seeing a continued attack on the civilian population, like the floor massacres at the Qadi roundabout, where over 400 people, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, have been murdered. Simply men going out, fathers, sons, uncles, grandfathers, simply going out to try and get some flour in order to save their families and help them going forward in this genocidal famine that has been weaponized as a form of collective punishment in order to subdue and force the Palestinian people into submission. So we're seeing famine, we're seeing bombs, we're seeing attacks on hospitals, schools. There was an attack on the UN aid distribution center just recently, and there were many wounded and some dead, and it's just a complete attack on the whole. It's a psychological war upon the whole people of Gaza in this genocidal American EU-backed ethnic cleansing of the people of Palestine.
Well, Tim Anderson, you had this U.S. intelligence report that came out days ago, and it mentioned a number of things. One of them was about the Hamas fighters, and it said that the Hamas fighters are going to pose a challenge for Israel for years to come. When you take into account the lack of accomplishment in terms of one of the stated goals of Israel, which is eradicating Hamas, in particular when it comes to the tunnels, for example, they have failed there. What does that tell the Israeli regime? Obviously, they're not doing something right there.
Well, you're right. This is reported in the Zionist media also, that they the U.S. intelligence group said that they're not going to be able to get rid of Hamas, because really Hamas is just the tip of the Palestinian resistance iceberg, and that's not going to go away anytime soon, basically. But when you're talking about Al-Shifa, remember also this is a hospital that was devastated before. It's in the north in Gaza City. There are still civilians there, even though conditions of life have been very difficult in the areas. All of the residential areas being devastated around there. There also is resistance there. The resistance is back in areas where the Israelis thought they'd got rid of them. So the civilians are there. And really, of course, this idea that they're actually going after Hamas is only part of the story. Anyway, let's remember that they have said many times to us, you know, and this is what the South Africans have carried to the International Court of Justice. They want to destroy the conditions of life to make it unbearable. They want to destroy the people or drive them out. And of course, this new port that the US is involved in is widely suspected now of being a way to try and evacuate and take Palestinians out of Gaza to help with the ethnic cleansing of the area. So the assault on civilians has always been a openly stated part of this genocide. Very few genocides in the past have openly stated as clearly as the Israelis have this one. So this new attack on Al-Shifa tells us, well, there are still civilians there, there is still resistance there, the Israelis are back there, they're trying to make conditions of life unbearable for the people there, because they have these dreams of turning it into a car park or some new tourist resort after they've got rid of the inconvenient fact of the fact that people still live there.
So if I was to correctly understand you, you said that the Gaza port is actually set up by the U.S. in order to have a way for the Palestinians to be removed from the Gaza Strip?
This is being widely discussed now because, after all, the idea of creating a port in a few weeks, over a few weeks, is ridiculous when you consider there are six or seven land crossings there. There are hundreds of trucks at the Rafah crossing, for example. So there is even a little bit of aid getting in now, and even some of it getting through to the north, apparently. But the US, if it wanted to get aid in, would simply tell the Israelis to open up the Gaza crossing to the trucks there, basically. This idea of building a port cannot have anything to do with the idea of getting aid in there. Similarly with the airdrops, which were tokenistic and very dangerous in many respects. So the idea of having the US Navy in there, having a base there, it's of course the US military does what the US military does. They're going to help the Israeli military. They've always already announced that the Israeli military is going to control security for this base. And the wide discussion now is that it could be a means of trying to evacuate desperate people and distribute them through the Mediterranean or into some parts of Africa, for example, getting rid of the people, which are the major inconvenience for the Zionist regime at the moment.
Sure. And Frau Hughes, if that's the case, in some ways that goes against what this most recent ceasefire proposal that has been now sent by Hamas, waiting for the Israeli regime and the U.S. Response. What do you think about that? Do you think that we're looking at the ceasefire proposal to maybe be successful or not?
Well, I don't think Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet want peace. I don't think they want negotiations. I don't think they want a settlement. I think they want the war to continue. And this whole idea of when I originally heard about the port proposal, I actually thought they were just giving the Israelis another 2 months to continue their ground offensive in Rafah and to try and wrap up this whole situation. Because from the very start, Biden and the American administration have given the Israeli war criminals in the war cabinet the green light to just kill as many Palestinians as they wish. So, as I say, originally I thought perhaps that's what this was. You know, it's good cop, bad cop. The Americans and the EU are saying, oh, Israel won't let the food in. We don't have any control over this. Netanyahu's a rogue element trying to continue in power with his by continuing the genocidal war in Gaza. So we're going to build this port. It's going to take 60 days. And then we'll be able to get aid in. When we all know Biden to pick up the phone and in a matter of 1 minute, open up all 7 borders between Egypt and Israel to allow the thousands of aid trucks that are there to allow all that food, medicine, clothes, fresh water, anesthesia to enter the strip. I could see the possibility that it could be used to encourage people to leave as a waterway, as a gateway, not to Europe, because there's no way the racists and the white supremacists in the EU would ever take Palestinian refugees. So yes, it's possible they could be going to Africa. There's also a possibility that it would be used purely for control of, if Israel said we are never letting anything into Gaza once this is over, this port could be the only international access to bring aid into Gaza if the people are still there at the end of this genocidal war. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that the Israelis will again decide to decide how many calories goes in, what type of reconstruction you know, bulldozers and cement and building blocks and all, everything that's necessary to rebuild Gaza. They might have total control of it. I've mentioned in the past that they will decide who will be the Arab donors, Qatar and others, I presume, to help in the rebuilding process. But from day to day, we don't know what's a lie, what's propaganda, and what's a truth.
Thank you so much. Farhi is journalist, author, and activist. And thank you, Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. With that, we come to an end for this news review. The Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has called for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying Palestinians need the Israeli bombs to stop. Varadkar said that Gazans desperately need food, medicine, and shelter. He also said Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that is unfolding before their eyes in Gaza. The Premier also called on the U.S. to secure a truce and to create space for lasting peace. He made the comments during a meeting with the U.S. President at the White House. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has also raised the alarm over the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the territory.
We are all extremely concerned about the war in Gaza and the unfolding catastrophic humanitarian situation. Gaza is facing famine, and we cannot accept this. It is critical to achieve an agreement on a ceasefire rapidly now, that frees the hostages and allows more humanitarian aid to reach Gaza.
Von der Leyen also voiced concern about Israel's threat for a full-scale offensive in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. She said it would have a devastating impact on the civilian population. She made the comments in a joint presser with the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo. Sisi also opposed any Israeli ground operation in Rafah that would further deteriorate the humanitarian crisis. He also underlined Egypt's opposition to any Israeli attempt to forcibly displace Palestinians from their homes. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched multiple short-range ballistic missiles amid growing tensions in the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says it detected the launches early Monday. It says the missiles flew around 300 kilometers before coming down in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. The new development comes as the U.S. Secretary of State is in South Korea for talks. Washington and Seoul wrapped up their latest joint war games last week. Pyongyang considers such drills rehearsals for invasion. Let's get an idea about this from Frank Smith, a correspondent who joins us. Frank Smith, tell us about the launch and what it entailed. And at this point, if we've had reactions from South Korea on this.
Well, the launch of these missiles, especially at this time, is coordinated with the visit of the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to South Korea, no doubt. It's seeking to send a message to the United States that North Korea needs to be dealt with, or the U.S. and South Korea are going to face repercussions down the road. North Korea is under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions. It wants to be able to trade like a normal country in the international community, and yet because of these, again, U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang, it's largely unable to do so. This is also a message perhaps aimed at the U.S. in terms of the current administration and a potential Trump administration. The more of these provocations that take place, the more embarrassing really it is for the Biden administration and its failure in diplomacy or the management of security relations in East Asia, at the same time sending a message to incoming, potentially, a new president, former President Donald Trump, who engaged in symmetry with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, that Kim Jong-un may still be a subject for negotiations with a potential Trump administration down the road.
Thank you very much for that. Correspondent Frank Smith there from Seoul. Thank you, Frank. In Russia, near-final results of the presidential election show that the incumbent, Vladimir Putin, is on course for another six-year term in office. According to Russia's Central Election Commission, Putin has garnered over 87% of the vote, with over 95% of the ballots counted. None of the three other candidates has reached even 5%. Vote counting began minutes after polls closed on Sunday across the country, as well as in four Ukrainian regions annexed by Russia in 2022. For the first time, the election took place for 3 days, starting from Friday. Election officials say the nationwide turnout was over 74%. This is the eighth presidential election in Russia, and the fifth term for Putin if he is declared winner. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin has issued a warning to the West over the Ukraine war shortly after early results of Russia's presidential election showed that he will remain in power. Putin says the presence of Western troops in Ukraine can put the world on the verge of World War III.
I think that anything is possible in the modern world, but I've already said this, and it is clear to everyone that this conflict between Russia and NATO will be just one step away from a full-scale World War III. I don't think anybody is interested in this. NATO military are present there in Ukraine. There's nothing good in this. Firstly for them, because they get killed in large numbers.
Putin also touched upon peace talks over Ukraine. He expressed Russia's readiness for talks on a French proposal for a ceasefire during this summer's Olympic Games. However, Putin said that he will take into account Russia's interests on the front line of the war. The president added that Russian armed forces hold the initiative on the battlefield as they have made advances in Ukraine. On Saturday, the French president said that his country will ask Moscow to observe a ceasefire in Ukraine during the Olympic Games, where Russian athletes are banned to compete under their country's flag. People in different countries across the globe continue to voice solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. In Netherlands' capital, hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrators gathered outside of the National Holocaust Museum for the second time since last week. The demonstration came as a delegation from the Israeli regime was visiting the National Holocaust Museum. Protesters held pictures of the children killed in Israeli bombings in Gaza. They called for an immediate end to the ongoing genocidal war in the besieged Strip. In another European capital, London, people displayed their support for the Palestinians during a rally against racism. They called for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Also in Italy, hundreds of protesters gathered in Milan in support of the Palestinians. The demonstrators held signs reading "Stop the genocide in Gaza" and "Stop arming Israel." The German city of Berlin was also the scene of a massive rally. The protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They carried blood-stained small mock body bags in reference to the large number of children killed in Gaza. In Bahrain, which has normalized ties with Israel, protesters hailed the Palestinian resistance fighters and decried the U.S. for the Israeli bloodletting in Gaza. Also in Chile and South America, a massive rally was held in the capital Santiago, with protesters denouncing Israel for the killing of over 16,000 children in Gaza. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
This Ramadan, the residents of Gaza are facing famine due to the occupying regime's policy of deliberate starvation, with the sole objective being to make Gaza virtually uninhabitable. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, Ramadan, one of the most sacred months for Muslims worldwide, blends spiritual introspection with family life in the community, especially during the breaking of the fast known as Iftar. But for the inhabitants of the war-ravaged Gaza, this month will be different from all previous ones. Gaza has been enduring a genocidal war marked by bombings, siege, and the dehumanization of Palestinians. This dehumanization turns children, pregnant women, and the elderly into legitimate targets of Zionist colonial brutality. Harrowing images from Gaza have become symbols of the cruelty of the settler colonial entity. This Ramadan, the residents of Gaza are facing famine due to the occupying regime's policy of deliberate starvation, with the sole objective being to make Gaza virtually uninhabitable. This situation arises because the Zionist regime has failed to weaken the Hamas resistance group militarily or propose a plan for Gaza's future that does not involve Hamas as a representative of the people. As a consequence of these abject failures, the Zionist regime has opted for a new strategy in Gaza to create a situation where no one emerges victorious, even though it is the regime that has faced defeat. The strategy of rendering Gaza uninhabitable and ungovernable involves provoking absolute chaos in the territory and creating a situation of full-scale famine. According to this toxic colonial strategy, if no political force is capable of maintaining even a minimum of governmental stability in the territory, it becomes entirely dependent on humanitarian aid. In the case of Gaza, the famine strategy designed by the Zionist colonial occupation is complemented by the distribution of humanitarian aid by the United States, described by many as a show, reinforcing the dependency of the Palestinian territory and keeping it in a state of permanent chaos. Already, nearly 31,200 Palestinians, including 14,000 children and 9,000 children, have died due to the genocidal war. The famine imposed by the Zionist regime has claimed the lives of at least 27 people, most of them children, who died due to malnutrition and dehydration. The images of malnourished bodies have become common on social media in recent days, even though the mainstream Western media continues to reduce these colossal human losses into cold statistics. The graphic images of mutilated bodies or malnourished babies are part of the daily reality faced by Palestinians. The issue is not to create despair or evoke sympathy, but to expose the atrocities of Zionist colonial occupation, which has assumed frightening proportions since October 7th. The Zionist regime obsessively concerns itself with its public image, making desperate attempts to hide its genocidal crimes. However, in the battle for narratives, Zionist Hasbara, the propaganda organ of the colonial entity, has failed to conceal the reality of genocide and starvation it has imposed on Palestinians. During this holy month, it is also important to highlight the colonial expansion in other parts of Palestine, such as in the occupied West Bank. Last week, the colonial entity approved the construction of more illegal settlements in the region. Many tougher restrictions have also been imposed on Palestinian worshippers from accessing the Al-Aqsa Mosque during this sacred month, with reports of multiple deadly raids in several parts of occupied Al-Quds, resulting in the death of at least 4 Palestinians. One of them was a 13-year-old boy who was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper while bursting firecrackers outside his house near Shafat camp in occupied Al-Quds. The genocide and starvation in Gaza are meticulously designed to inflict harm and create atrocious conditions for the local population. Several Gaza residents have spoken about the deliberate destruction of farmland in the area, aiming to keep the population subdued and deprived of any ability to feed themselves. The destruction of fertile soil in Gaza with the clear aim of causing famine can also be understood through the decision of the occupying army to flood tunnels with seawater.
According to several experts, this action would have led to the destruction of these soils and their potential agricultural use. Amidst death and destruction, the child killer regime of Israel continues its psychological warfare against Palestinians. The leaflets dropped by the regime urged people to feed the needy, which rights activists perceive as a cruel irony given the situation of famine imposed by the regime itself. The message of feeding the needy reveals the insignificance of Palestinian lives to the colonial forces. Furthermore, it underscores the dehumanization of the Palestinian population and, along with it, the normalization of extermination, domination, exploitation, premature death, and even conditions worse than death, such as ruthless torture. For decades, Palestinians have lived in constant anticipation of death, a reality dating back even before 1947. Colonized individuals live anticipating degradation, humiliation, and murder. During the month of Ramadan, the Muslim community is particularly aware of the divine blessings in their daily lives. The notion of divinity should not be interpreted as something separate from earthly reality. On the contrary, the divinity of the Quran implies a political struggle to establish a just community in this world. We cannot speak of justice, much less build a just society, while Gaza and the rest of Palestine continue to suffer genocide and starvation. This must be the message during Ramadan.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as the Israeli regime's genocide against Palestinians continues, more than 31,600 people have been killed. This includes the slaughtering of over 13,000 infants and kids. As Netanyahu continues to say Israel has a right to defend itself, more and more settler colonialists inside of the regime are protesting and clashing with police. They say regime leaders have created more insecurity for the people and have not freed the captives. The settler colonialists want a change in the regime. This has increasingly some of the regime's closest allies are starting to, at least on the surface, distance themselves from Netanyahu. But in reality, what does it all mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on The Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Sarah Flounders, International Action Center out of New York. And Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome both of you to the program. Let me start it off in New York. And Sarah, is the main problem with the Israeli regime due to Netanyahu being prime minister, or is the reality beyond who is prime minister?
Well, it is far beyond Netanyahu. This is Zionist policy from day one for 75 years and even earlier. But right now, there are U.S. politicians that are desperate to save Israel as a Zionist outpost for U.S. domination and power in the region. And they seem to think maybe the only way forward is to dump Netanyahu. Clearly, that was true in Senator Schumer's statements the other day, and an increasing number of politicians. They face a real problem, that Israel's global reputation has been absolutely destroyed. It's clearly been proven it's no longer invincible. It's certainly not. The Iron Dome, the new tanks, the missiles, the weapons, they have all been found to be not so invincible at all. But also Israel's reputation, its standing, has been completely destroyed. And overwhelmingly, even here in the U.S., more than two-thirds of the population is for the Palestinians. Now, that's a big problem for U.S. politicians, Democrat and Republican. They're both Zionists, absolutely. But they face an election coming up, so they got to act like they're for something different. Whether there's anything different that's even possible, that's a real question, because everything means they still want Israel to survive, and that is what is being threatened and challenged by a unified resistance.
Well, Said Mohsen, we've seen across the board support for the genocide in Gaza from all factions of the Israeli regime, as well as from the settler colonialists on the ground themselves. I mean, your thoughts overall, is there actually a divide between the people and that regime? And is it related to the genocide itself, or is it related to how they are being affected by it all?
Well, it's a very fascinating situation internally. The people, the Jewish occupation of citizenry, etc., is certainly behind the war. They're certainly behind the genocidal tactics being used by Netanyahu, but they're not necessarily for Benjamin Netanyahu himself. He was in trouble long before this war, and in fact there were all sorts of issues constitutionally and in terms of the whole the grave political, constitutional and domestic crisis which he'd brought about through his own efforts to try to reduce the judiciary's power, to increase his own power, to bring in essentially a Jewish religious jurisprudence of a hugely fundamentalist nature. There was hardly anything secular left within the plans that they were rolling out. And essentially, he's increased the racist approach to Palestinians, if that could be increased anymore, with the necessity that he's created of support from ultra-nationalists, ultra-extreme, violent Jewish politicians like Smotrich and all the other entourage that have become very infamous across the screens. But in reality also, that public which is backing the war, which also doesn't necessarily like Netanyahu, is hugely aware now that the entire north part of Israel has been evacuated. So the war, which by extension obviously drew in Hezbollah, has essentially created a huge deal of paranoia. I mean, entire settlements in that northern part of occupied Palestine had to be evacuated. That's one result of this war, which gets little coverage. But the Israeli public is even more insecure as a result of this, because don't forget, what they haven't forgiven Netanyahu for is the failure of security. He was Mr. Security, and yet what he's done in October the 7th has created the biggest amount of paranoia and insecurity among the Israeli public that's ever been known. On top of that, he's failed on the retrieval of hostages. He's failed in terms of wiping out Hamas, which was another pledge of his. What he has done is also undermined Israel's cover story, which was that they were the victims and that the Palestinians were terrorists. Now, well, of course, what's happened is the whole world sees the emperor is naked. Mm-hmm. They can realize that he has no clothes and that all the lies of the Hasbara are there for the world to see. And I think Israel's standing certainly won't recover from this. What the implications of that are for its long-term survival are, of course, open to debate.
Well, Sarah, the demonstrations on Saturday in Tel Aviv and other cities led to the first major clashing amongst Israelis and security forces since October the 7th. Is this significant and indicative of a transition taking place inside of the regime, in your perspective?
Well, there has been a growing number of demonstrations, disruptions, encampments, vigils going on within Israel among the Zionist forces. They are deeply, completely divided, and the animosity and the failure of security that rankles deep. And it will grow worse and worse because in the hundreds of thousands, Israelis have left Israel itself, either to avoid being drafted or just wanting no part of this war. That's a big loss. The economy is in shambles. Unemployment is really higher than it's ever been. And their standing in the world is completely shattered and lost. So the divisions are real, and the growing actual fights, repression, you know, so on, are becoming stronger and stronger. The failure on every front of the aims of the war in terms of regaining the hostages, defeating Hamas, all that, here it is more than 5 months in, and they haven't succeeded in anything. So that will mean greater division and greater hostility within the state, which is an illusion from its very beginning. So now you have millions of people waking up and frustrated and angry. So will they break with Zionism? Very few of them, because the racism is so deeply ingrained. But will they break in all kinds of ways against the government? That's what it certainly looks like is happening. And then there also are voices who really were never for this policy, who are becoming more outspoken and gutsy. So there are a lot of tensions going on in Israel today, and also the big thing that everyone in Israel knows is that world support has completely broken and U.S. support is waning. So this is a fragile effort from the very beginning, and now it's in really, you know, bad shape. Israel can't prevail, and as I say, they've lost support everywhere. It's a failed party, and that will create greater and greater tension, animosity, opposition within the Israeli state.
Well, Sid Mohsen, speaking of the captives, I mean, protesters say that Netanyahu has done nothing to try to reach a deal to bring the captives home. Do you think that the reality is that the regime leaders really did not want the captives to be returned home?
Well, the Hannibal Directive is something which is on record, and it's something which the Israeli establishment had decided was going to be a policy, and they've exercised that policy quite ruthlessly. It essentially says that in a situation where hostages or Israeli lives can be saved, and the alternative, of course, is to stop their military actions, they will always plumb for sacrificing the hostages. And that's what Netanyahu has done, essentially. He's actually responsible for directly killing many of those hostages. Many of them have been essentially murdered alongside all those women and children, the 31,000 plus and who've been killed from the Palestinian civilian fraternity. So his own people's blood is on his hands. There are huge questions he has to answer in terms of what his military forces were doing on October the 7th, when they sent in Apache helicopters and mowed down Israeli citizens, essentially. You know, he's got to answer for those issues. So to be honest with you, there is a clear set of evidence that this establishment's incompetence in dealing with this whole situation from start to finish, and it's now very well documented genocide and ethnic cleansing and starvation of a people who are already destitute and on their last legs is recorded, and he is now spoken, ultimately, he's going to be spoken in the same breath as names like Pol Pot, Hitler, and Churchill, I'd like to add, because these people were all responsible for some of the biggest genocides of the 20th century. Well, congratulations, Netanyahu, you've managed to get yourself in an auspicious list there, and that won't go away. Israel itself is now also tarred with that brush. Nobody's buying the victim story. But what they will do is they'll try and, their advisors are already trying to do this. What they're planning is to meet this challenge by essentially getting new political realignments done in the backgrounds. So Benny Gantz and the National Unity Party, for instance, will be pushed, I think, into the foreground as the replacement. They'll probably try and bring together some kind of coalition, which will try to, patch things over. I mean, they've already tripled their popularity in the various general election polls. So we know that the NUP will be rewarded for this war, and Benny Gantz is the one to watch. But then Benny Gantz's policies are not going to be that different from Netanyahu. He's part and parcel of this Zionist terrorist mindset. And unless they are willing to really give the rights of Palestinians, unless they're willing to concede the land and give people back their properties, allow the repatriation of all Palestinians expelled and their heritage, children who've been born abroad, unless they're willing to settle for a one-state solution which is based on democracy and the rights of Palestinians, we're not going to see an end to this situation.
Right.
In fact, what they've done is they've bred an entire generation of Palestinians who will now fight, literally fight, for the return of their people's rights.
Well, Sarah, some of the protesters were saying that the policy has to change by the Israeli regime towards Palestinians, or Israel will no longer exist. Your assessment of that statement, I mean, is there a greater awareness by the settler colonialists that the regime is in danger?
I think so, Marzia, and I very much agree with Syed that what it would take, though, is something which would really mean the end of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it means the return of these settlements. It means, Israel out of Gaza. It means the end of the attacks. That's the only way, and that seems to be almost an impossibility. That's not on Benny Gantz's agenda or any of the Israeli politicians. So that is the quandary. They have an absolutely failed war. They're no longer clearly invincible. That's been completely destroyed. And dumping Netanyahu or a new coalition government won't fix this, won't solve it. And the U.S. is desperately seeking for a way to act like they're not for this policy, they're for something else. Can they restabilize? And that doesn't seem to be in the works. It's not in the works even because of the actions taken in Yemen by the Ansarullah movement. The blockade, the Israeli ports are all but closed. So while they have imposed a complete closure and created a famine in Gaza, they haven't been able to open their own economy as a thriving economy it was. So they can't seem to prevail anywhere, either economically or militarily. The big win that they expected, it isn't in the cards with any of the Israeli politicians. This is a real crisis that they face, and actually that U.S. imperialism faces, because they have completely banked on Israel from its very foundation, and now they see it literally crumbling. They see the population at each other's throats, and many others just opting to leave out of the whole project. It's a big problem, and it's part of global change that is really happening among many countries realigning and rethinking where they stand.
Well, speaking of that, actually, of that realignment, said Mohsen, as the regime continues to be adamant about its invasion of Rafah and continues to commit mass murder on a daily basis, do you think that there is real distancing taking place on an international level of some of the international allies of the regime, or is it just for show?
I think there's a lot of show. There's no genuineness about the allies. The allies are fully part and parcel of the genocide. They've been aiding and abetting the murder of the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, with weapon supplies. Hundreds of thousands of tons of weapons from Germany, from Britain, from America have been pouring in. Their alliances are just as solid as they were before. In fact, what one has to realize that Israel is their means for controlling West Asia. But what's happened is that Israel's own, invincibility has been undermined so much that it's putting doubts in erstwhile allies. This is what's really important. The likes of Saudi Arabia, the likes of Jordan, Egypt, all these collaborators in the genocide of Palestine, because don't forget the Saudis have been allowing food and commodities to come through their territories into Jordan via UAE. Don't forget that Egypt has been trying to prevent Yemeni ballistic missiles reaching Israel, and are also wholly and solely responsible for the starvation that's going on also from the Rafah crossing, because they are also hand in glove with Israel with this policy. So it's this exposure of the regional, Israeli allies, covert, many of them previously covert, now are exposed. Saudi Arabia is finding increasingly embarrassing. Turkey and the likes of Azerbaijan have been exposed for their oil exports. So Israel's actions have actually exposed all of the collaborators, and the public knows. The Arab public in the region now knows. And I think that realization isn't going to go away. It will affect those governments, and it's also exposed the likes of the Zionist Western establishment, clearly, and China.
Stay
and Russia
with me, said Mohsen, because I only have a couple of minutes left. I want to get a couple more questions in. Well, Sarah, U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, a staunch Zionist supporter of the regime in Washington, has said that Netanyahu has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace. What are your thoughts on why Schumer is saying that now, and what does it really mean?
Well, Schumer is an arch Zionist, strongest Zionist, longest supporter of Israel in the U.S., top representative. So Netanyahu has lost his way, and it just means Schumer is in a panic, how to distance himself from this politician who's now radioactive. That is the problem. And so Schumer's got to act like he's for something different. What it is, he doesn't say. And frankly, he doesn't know. That is what they can't overcome. And it's also true in the U.S. and Britain. These are the supporters, the EU, these are the supporters of Zionism from the very beginning. And now, frankly, they are scared. They are worried, and they don't have an option. That this is the quandary that they're in.
Okay.
And the regime that were complicit in Western Asia, and I'm talking about, as I did, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, they're also now looking east. They are looking to new relations. There no longer is the U.S. and the, you know, that imperialist economy the only game in town.
Okay, stay with me, Sarah. So sorry to interrupt you. And said Mohsen, at the end of the day, is there anything besides, or any group besides the resistance that is going to bring this genocide against Palestinians in Gaza to an end?
No. The only chance that exists for the liberation of Palestinians, in my opinion, is the resistance of the people inside Palestine and the support of the resistance both in from Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and Yemen. I mean, the reality is that I don't know of any peoples in history who have managed to overthrow the kind of oppressor that Israel is, the kind of vicious oppressor that Israel ideologically is, by peaceful means. And we've not seen any evidence for the Western powers or the UN or any of the apparatus controlled by the Anglo-Zionist Empire in really being serious to create any solution for Palestinians. Okay. We're seeing more and more of the same. It has to be a military resistance which is going to ultimately achieve Israel's downfall.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Sarah Flanders from the International Action Center out of New York, Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
Take pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is ar-Rahman? Allah, who is al-Mannan? La
ilaha. Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom and Islamic scholar, Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to discuss another interesting topic regarding Islamic topics. It's very much related to a relation between Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and human beings in terms of the creation. Now, the major question is that it is believed, and according to the verses of ayahs of the Holy Quran, we have that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blow some of his spirit into the spirit or the soul of the human beings. So if the human's soul is consisted of the Allah's soul, why chastisement for some of the people in the other world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we should know that, as you rightly mentioned in the Holy Quran, it is mentioned explicitly that our soul is, our spirit is from Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's soul. وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي. This is the phrase that we have in the Holy Quran. And since Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not, let's say, obliged or majbur, as we can say, or predestinedly do something, that's why he is of free will. Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has free will.
Yes.
So this is the nature of the soul that we are bestowed upon by Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
That's why our soul is also equipped with free will. And we are free. So that's why, since we are free, since we have this capability to decide freely either to go to the right path or the wrong path, mm-hmm. it is our own decision, then we ourselves built either Jannah for ourselves,
yes,
or hell and Jahannam for ourselves. Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us not for punishment, rather for gaining perfection, gaining proximity to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But of course, since we have this free will and we have this irada and ikhtiyar, as it is mentioned in the riwayat, based on which some of the people freely decide not to follow the right path.
Yes.
Then, of course, the punishment will be the consequences of their own deeds, not a divinely decision.
That's all right. So, and this is, I think, a very important